This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, in his recent special message on energy, Governor Snyder provided his outline for a more secure, reliable energy future for Michigan. Let's get some reactions to that special message on energy from a highly respected energy expert. He is Stanley Skip Pruss. Skip is currently the co-founder and principal of Five Lakes Energy, which is a clean energy technology consultancy. Before that, and I think the last time you were on the program, Skip, you were director of the Department of Energy, Labor, and Economic Growth and Michigan's chief energy officer. Good to have you back on the program.
Great to be here, Kirk.
Well, let's get right to it. Before we get into some specifics on the energy message, what were your overall reactions?
Well, I think there was a lot to like in the governor's message. He set a high bar. The governor indicated that Michigan should meet 30 to 40% of its future energy needs through renewable energy and energy efficiency. We can easily make that standard, but it is a high bar. It's ambitious, and that was a good thing. I also appreciated the fact that he delivered his energy plan through a special message to the legislature. That's a formal process. It was very transparent. It was very detailed. That was a good thing. And then lastly, I was impressed by the fact that the governor knew enough about energy policy to get up on a stage and talk about in detail about energy policy for an hour in introducing his plan to the public.
Well, Skip, you were one of the architects for the 10% renewable energy by 2015, our energy portfolio, renewable energy portfolio. I know you're very proud of that, but there are those downtown who would like to, instead of moving forward on the renewable energy front, actually scale it back.
Yeah, so it's almost inconceivable, isn't it?
Yes.
Given the success of what we've witnessed in the last 4 or 5 years, the renewable portfolio standard for Michigan that requires 10% of our energy to be derived from renewable energy sources is an unqualified success. It cost less than half than what was anticipated in 2008. We're doing it ahead of schedule. It means cheaper energy in the long run for Michigan businesses and Michigan homeowners. It's a hedge, really, against future energy price rises because all of these zero-fuel renewable energy resources are under long-term contracts with fixed prices for 20 years. So it's a really good thing. And as the governor indicated, and as governors around the country are doing, we're requiring more renewable energy and more energy efficiency, which should always be the first thing we do.
Now, as you know, the 10% was required by legislative mandate. Governor Snyder's talking 30 to 40% of renewable energy without legislative mandate. Does that trouble you at all? I mean,
well,
sort of a voluntary almost approach to this.
It is. We need a vehicle for this. You know, the economics of renewable energy and energy efficiency is so compelling that there's impetus to do more of it, but we do need the mandate. And, you know, this notion that mandates somehow interfere with the market is ironic, to say the least. Our utilities are natural monopolies. They essentially have no competition. They get a fixed rate of return, so there's very little business risk, and they're heavily regulated already. So it's entirely appropriate for the legislature or the Michigan Public Service Commission to set standards for them for Michigan's energy portfolio.
Skip, one of the things the governor mentioned, and maybe a lot of listeners are not aware of, but Michiganians use approximately 35 to 38% more energy on average than the rest of the United States. Why in the world would that be?
Well, we have cold winters. We use a lot of natural gas. Actually, there are some states that consume a whole lot of energy, and Michigan is one of them because we are a manufacturing state. I think we're either eighth or ninth in terms of total energy load from manufacturing. So that brings us up there. But on a per capita basis, in terms of energy use, we're really somewhere below the middle.
Somewhere below the middle in terms of per capita. So
right.
That number is a little bit deceiving.
A little bit, based upon the statistics by the Energy Information Agency.
What about the additional cost we pay for energy in Michigan? Is that also a statistic that's deceiving in some, or do we actually pay more here in Michigan?
Well, so nationally, we're slightly above the national average, or at about the national average. Regionally, among Great Lakes states, we are the highest cost, but only marginally so. But that does, you know, there's a real important distinction to be made between the price of energy and total cost to the business or to the homeowner. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Michigan, with our northern climate, uses less air conditioning and therefore less electricity. And where our homeowners may pay a slightly higher rate, we use less electricity. So the overall cost is really less than Ohio.
Back to Governor's special message, he put a lot of emphasis on energy conservation. That's something that he's emphasized. I know in the Granholm administration, you did as well. I mean, I think everybody gets on board when it comes to conservation of energy.
Yeah, the energy that we don't use is always cheaper and is always cleaner than the energy that we have to produce to meet that need. So energy of efficiency is the first thing that we should always do. The Michigan Public Service Commission is required by law to do an annual report to the legislature that analyzes the economics of renewable energy and energy efficiency. And what the Public Service Commission has found, and this is consistent across the years now, is that Michigan ratepayers are saving about about $700 million a year. In addition to that, the Pew Charitable Trust there has done a report called Clean Economy Rising for Michigan, and they documented that Michigan, our energy efficiency has added about $2.9 billion to Michigan's economy. Renewable energy has added about $4.9 billion to Michigan economy.
Substantial numbers.
70,000 jobs in these fields. So it is important to the economy, and energy optimization, energy efficiency should always be the first thing that we do.
We actually talked to some folks that were involved in that Pew report, and Michigan has made some substantial strides, particularly on the wind front, as you know. How solar, not so much so. Talk to us a little bit about the potential for solar here in Michigan.
Well, so it's a conundrum. It's so, you know, we talk about watts and kilowatts, which are thousands of watts, and megawatts, which are millions of watts, and gigawatts, which are billions of watts. So nationally, by the end of 2014, in the United States, we've deployed 17.5 billion watts, gigawatts of solar energy. But in Michigan, we've only deployed 25 megawatts. Less than 1/1500 of 1% of the solar deployed in the nation has been in Michigan. Now, obviously, that's not a good thing. New Jersey, a state with less solar radiation than Michigan, deploys more solar energy almost every quarter than Michigan has to date. So it speaks to policy being important, and we need policies that push solar. The silver lining on all of this is that solar is coming. We are going to deploy a lot of it in the future, and because the price is coming down so quickly of both solar modules and the cost of installation, that Michigan will be the beneficiary of those lower prices once we get going on doing serious implementations.
There was a breaking story recently that was very optimistic. The Board of Water and Light, the energy provider in Lansing, talking about a huge solar array in Lansing.
So that is really interesting, because the Lansing Board of Water and Light, at least to my understanding, was looking at 5 megawatts, a small utility scale solar project, and the bids came in so low for the solar energy from that project that they've essentially increased the size, the proposed size, by a factor of 4. So that, just to be precise here, the solar energy from the Lansing Board and Water of Light's projects is going to be about 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour. And the cost of energy from a new coal plant would be about 13.3 cents a kilowatt hour. So it's about half already, and the price is going down. So that's why I say solar is coming, and we're going to see a lot of it.
And I might just add that 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour is what I pay when I charge my Volt in the garage every night, as long as I start charging after 10 p.m.
Well, it's great that you have a Volt in your garage, yeah. And I hope it's solar powered.
Skip, let's talk about the governor did talk a lot about natural gas as part of the energy portfolio. There's a lot of controversy surrounding particularly the high-pressure hydraulic fracturing. The governor seemed to indicate that as long as we do things right environmentally, that this hydraulic fracturing and natural gas exploration will continue in Michigan. Your thoughts?
Well, so here, this may be a surprising fact, but it's becoming pretty clear that the formations in Michigan that we have for natural gas aren't as robust as once anticipated. In fact, the major natural gas developers that would use fracking technologies to develop that resource have really essentially pulled out in Michigan. It may be the case that if the price for natural gas increased substantially, that we would see more activity and they may come back, but we're not going to see a lot of it now. One of the principal concerns with fracking, and actually there are several, is that it consumes a tremendous amount of water.
The water issue, yeah.
There's a potential for contamination of both aquifers and surface waters through the flowback that you get, because a lot of chemicals and additives are used in order to keep those pores open so the gas can flow. But at least in the short term and looking at the medium term, I wouldn't anticipate a lot of fracking activity in Michigan. So I think overall that's a good thing. We need natural gas. We need to have a reliable, adaptable energy supply. But I'm weary of investing a lot of money, you know, hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in natural gas plants that may be obsolete in a very short period of time.
My guest is Skip Press, who is co-founder and principal of Five Lakes Energy, LLC, also a former Michigan's chief energy officer. We're talking water, and we just got word about California's mandate now to reduce the water consumption by 25%. That just broke. Been out to California recently. It's amazing out there. You can't talk about energy or you can't talk about water separately, can you, Skip? I mean, the nexus of those two is where we're headed.
They are inextricably interrelated. Here's a fact for you and your audience. 76% of all water withdrawals in the Great Lakes energy is for thermoelectric plants, for the nuclear and coal and natural gas plants in the region. We have 144 coal units on the Great Lakes. And they're on the Great Lakes because of the availability of water for cooling. That's why we have such a high density. But to generate electricity requires a tremendous amount of water. And then on the flip side, to move water, to have a municipal drinking water supplies, wastewater treatment, to cool those plants requires a tremendous amount of energy to move that water. In fact, wastewater treatment systems and drinking water supplies consume 4% of our energy nationally, but in California, it's almost 20% because they have to move so much water.
Yeah, from the north to the south, historically.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that just points to the fact that we're blessed with the Great Lakes here, but we've got to do all that we can, obviously, to protect those Great Lakes, but at the same time, secure our energy future.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the other nexus, important nexus between energy and water is that the infrastructure that we have used so long that, you know, was tied to our prosperity, the coal plants and the natural gas plants, there's a cost that associates with it, that is associated with that. The airborne deposition of mercury, of acid gases, you know, that's why we have fish advisories in the Great Lakes, because we have this legacy of 75 years of mercury loadings and acid gases that impact the lakes. And now, for the first time in history, we have better choices.
Mm-hmm. Skip, we got about a minute left here, but as you review the governor's plan, think about all the good work that you folks did back in the Granholm administration. What do you like most about the plan, and what worries you about the plan?
Well, so what I like most about the plan is that it's an ambitious target. And the governor made clear he thinks that this is what we can achieve at the low end, which is a very good thing. But as you said, Kirk, the fact that we don't have a mechanism, that we don't have a vehicle or a standard that helps us get there, that doesn't provide the kind of certainty that we need for Michigan industries and Michigan investors to make it happen.
And frankly, it's unlikely we're going to get that kind of a standard out of this legislature.
It doesn't look that way, and that's a shame.
Yeah. But on the positive side, the ambitious goals, all the things that you said, a lot to look forward to, a lot to be hopeful about.
inevitably, we will get there, so I'm optimistic.
My guest has been Stanley Skip Press. He is the co-founder and principal of Five Lakes Energy, former chief energy officer for the state of Michigan. Skip, so good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
Recycle Michigan, a place where there's no city limit, no boundaries, and the population, 9.9 million. So where is Recycle Michigan? It's located in your home, next door, down the road, in your very own community. In their continued effort to increase recycling awareness, the Michigan Recycling Coalition has launched the statewide Recycle Michigan campaign. Serving as a resource to both businesses and residents, the Michigan Recycling Coalition provides simple steps to reduce waste, create awareness of the benefits of recycling, and to discover options for recycling through your local communities. By recycling, you, your family, your neighbors, and your community can help protect the things we love most about our state. Recycling junk mail, water bottles, and other containers will help keep our Great Lakes State clean, but it also promotes job growth in Michigan. Discover how you can become a citizen of Recycle Michigan by exploring MichiganRecycles.org.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, many of you out there know that there's an MSU Extension presence in or very near your community, but you may not know the range of programs and services that MSU Extension provides, programs and services that help sustain and advance communities. Here to provide a snapshot of some of those programs and services is Dr. Ray Hammerschmidt. Dr. Hammerschmidt is the interim director of MSU Extension. Ray, good to see you.
Thanks, Kirk. Good to be with you.
Before we talk about a couple of specific initiatives that are really exciting, tell us a little bit about the mission and the focus of Extension.
Well, the main mission of Extension is to provide the major outreach of Michigan State University, where we deliver research-based programs to the citizens of Michigan, as well as determine what issues they face and bring this knowledge back to campus, or these issues back to campus where our researchers can work on solving these problems. Within Extension, we have four major institutes, which cover agriculture and agribusiness, one of the traditional areas, children and youth, which has 4-H as its, one of its major components, the Health and Nutrition Institute, and also the Greening Michigan Institute, which covers everything from natural resources to state and local government.
And all of those institutes are germane to what we talk about on this program. But let's start with one that's fairly new and very exciting. It's called your Extension Health Research, or EHR. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this is a joint effort between the College of Human Medicine and our Health and Nutrition Institute. Dr. Jeff Dwyer, one of the Associate Deans in Human Medicine, and Dawn Contreras, our Health and Nutrition Institute Director, are running this program. What's really great about this is that we're placing, or the College of Human Medicine is placing faculty around the state and matching them with our educators. And the educators are there working in the communities, helping deliver the information, but at the same time, finding out what's going on in the communities and bringing this information back to the faculty.
And that's very much in line with the tradition not only of MSU Extension, but of our medical schools, which have been out in the communities historically, as opposed to university-based medical schools.
Well, absolutely. This is a perfect match, and it certainly lines up directly with the land-grant mission.
Speaking of the health and nutrition thing, too, again, this is a more of a traditional area for your folks as well, but the whole food chain from producer to consumer, we like to say from farm gate to consumer plate, but very important to Extension in your mission.
Absolutely. And one of the things which we have been working very hard on in delivering programs is the area of food safety. And this starts on the farm and goes all the way to the consumer. And one of the issues or reasons we're very interested in this particular area is that as recently as a few years ago, the Centers for Disease Control estimated that it cost about $6.9 million annually in dealing with foodborne illnesses. So stopping these kinds of issues early is very important. In 2013, for example, MSUE taught more than 4,000 residents how to preserve and prepare safe food for public consumption through our Extension Cottage Food Law workshops. We taught over 90,000 Michigan residents in the 2013-14 year on just basic safe food handling, preparation, and storage techniques. So we're reaching the wide range of not only our consumers, but also production agriculture.
And we have had, you know, Russ and I historically around the holiday season in particular have some of your extension educators on the program talking about the importance of preparing food in a safe, not only preparing, but then storing it as well.
Right, absolutely.
And it's amazing how many people get sick when they're not careful.
It's true. And that's why these programs, I think, are so well attended by the citizens around the state, because they want to learn what they can do to prepare safe food, store it, and serve it safely.
My guest is Dr. Ray Hammerschmidt. He's the interim director of Michigan State University Extension. Ray, let's take it back to the farm then, too, because agriculture is truly one of the bedrocks of MSU Extension, which do a lot of work with producers as well on the other end of the food chain.
Absolutely. As you know, we went through a little bit of a rough budget time a few years ago. We had to do some reductions in staff, both on campus as well as in our educator ranks, but we're building that capacity back. You know, I'm happy to say that we recently brought back two dairy educators, mm-hmm. one in Clinton County, one in Huron County, and we're working to supplement our educator corps throughout the state as our budget becomes better. One of the things which I'm really pretty proud of is the fact is we're doing a lot more work that's being supplemented by grants, mm-hmm. and this is really one of the ways of the future. Our traditional three-legged stool in extension is having our county partners, federal partners, right. and state partners, but grant support is becoming more important to really enhance and supplement the programs. Recently received a grant from DuPont Pioneer. Our educators worked with their counterparts in the University of Wisconsin to train agronomists from the company. This has turned out to be an amazingly successful program. It allows us to deliver our information to those company folks that work directly with the industry, as well as providing that background training we can provide to our traditional stakeholders through our traditional educational programs.
And that grant portfolio, as it grows, is just a nice way of leveraging taxpayers' dollars. So every dollar of taxpayers' money is leveraging money from
Absolutely.
The private sector.
And one of the things which the legislature challenged us with a few years ago was increasing our grant portfolio, and we're doing it, and we're right on track.
Let's go to another bedrock of MSU Extension, and this is perhaps the brand that most people are familiar with if they've been involved or they've had kids involved, but that's 4-H programs. Give us an update. Is 4-H still as strong as it has been historically?
4-H is going strong, and we're in all sorts of different areas that many folks don't even realize 4-H is involved in. But, for example, one of the things which we've had a very successful program in is developing leadership, and since 1982 or so, 75 to 100 Michigan teens have developed their leadership, citizenship, and civic engagement skills through the hands-on 4-H capital experience. Mm-hmm. We've also had successful programs with the Youth Conservation Council, which helps our young people find their passion, become leaders in their communities. They've been involved in actually helping provide information to help even some bills through our state legislature. MSU Extension's also actively involved in STEM education, and I think you'd consider we've always been involved in STEM education.
And for our listeners who may not know what STEM, that acronym stands for?
That's science, technology, engineering, and math.
Right.
But if you look at our traditional programs and our modern programs, there's always been a scientific basis for what these programs are all about. So we were involved in this before it became a popular acronym. But we've had 4-H animal and veterinary camps, natural resources camp. We've had bioenergy-related camps for the kids in the summertime, as well as the local programs, even programs dealing with robotics.
I could speak to that personally because every year one of your extension educators, Dennis Pennington, invites me to bring my Chevy Volt in so a bunch of 4-H'ers can get inside the car and look under the hood and figure out what a battery-powered car looks like. But that's typical of where some of these 4-H programs are interfacing with STEM.
Absolutely. And Dennis is a really good example. Mm-hmm. He's an agriculture educator, but his focus is on bioenergy and energy in general. And the fact that he's using, for example, his bioenergy camps is a way of introducing the students, our kids, not only to what energy policy and energy issues are all about, but how agriculture plays an important role in helping us have a more sustainable energy future.
Well, you know this, too. I mean, the interface between food and energy and water and those things, I mean, that is where things are headed. And I imagine 4-H programs specifically and extension programs in general are following that social direction.
Absolutely. Just like agriculture and the needs of our citizens aren't the same as they were when extension was founded in 1914, they're
right.
not the same as they were 10 years ago. So we continue to change at the time so we can maintain the relevant information and the cutting edge information that all of our stakeholders need and require.
But while programs change, that core mission that you mentioned at the outset of this interview, taking the knowledge from the university and moving it out into the great state of Michigan, is at the heart still of what Extension
does.
That's
absolutely correct, and that's why having such a great partnership with AgBioResearch and finding other resources on campus is so important for us, because they develop the content, we help deliver it through programs, but at the same time, it's our Extension educators and Extension specialists who are out there and have their fingers on the pulse of what's happening across the state.
Well, Ray, we had a lot of interaction when you were a department chair of plant pathology. You're fairly new to this Extension role, but you're doing a great job. We hope to have you on a regular basis. We can get some updates on some of your programs and also some of your educators, which we typically have on the program.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Kirk.
I've been talking with Dr. Ray Hammerschmidt. He is the director of MSU Extension.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. You know, we live in a time where people just don't join things anymore. So why are so many Spartans joining the MSU Alumni Association? Well, perhaps it's our world-class alumni enrichment team, constantly stretching Spartan minds and supercharging Spartan careers. Or perhaps it's our Spartan pipeline, which connects you to trusted friends wherever your adventures may take you. The MSU Alumni Association is dedicated to adding Spartan value to your Spartan life. Whatever it is that may be keeping you up at night, we can connect you with a fellow Spartan who can help. We truly live in a world where who you know is just as important as what you know. And joining the MSU Alumni Association can help you build the relationships you need for success on the job and in every corner of your Spartan life. That's why more and more Spartans are joining the MSU Alumni Association. Activate your membership right now at alumni.msu.edu.
Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Dr. Andrew Hoffman, who is the Holcomb Professor and Director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. And he's got a new book out, How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate, Stanford University Press. Good to talk to you again.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
About a third of the way through the book, you pose a compelling question. Why would people send hate mail and demonize people they don't know over the science related to climate change? The answer to this question is the point of the book. Andy, I'll let you take it from here. What is the point of the book?
The point of the book is that the public and political debate over climate change has morphed, and it is really not about science and CO2 or climate models. It's about values and worldviews, and people are reacting to a whole host of issues that they hear when they hear the words climate change or global warming, for that matter.
And you say at another point, they are not really engaging in a scientific debate when the vitriol starts to fly over data and models. You talk a lot about values. Talk about the importance of values and why values are sometimes not incorporated into the dialogue.
Well, for a lot of people, they just think that the scientific community has spoken and the people should just accept it. And a lot of scientists feel that science is not political. It's just data and models. But they say things like the data speak. But science is political. It is inherently social and political when you're asking people to change what they believe or how they behave. And so as people start to push forward for a recognition that we are altering the global climate, that challenges some people's notions about our place within the environment, our importance. Some people find that hubris to think that humans are that powerful. A lot of people distrust scientists. They distrust environmentalists. They distrust democratic politicians, and those are the primary spokesmen on climate change. And so I can go through the host of reasons that are in the book, but the key is that people make sense out of complex issues. by using what we call motivated reasoning. And I try not to use too much jargon in the book, but we look at things in a way, if we don't fully understand them, in a way that we seek to confirm our pre-existing worldview. And so if you hear something from someone that you distrust, you're automatically going to distrust them. And if it flies against some values you hold dear, you will resist it. And that's going back to the hate mail. Why would someone send hate mail over something that is seemingly a scientific issue? It's because what they're reacting to, and if you read the hate mail, it's in there, they're reacting to some deeply held beliefs and values that they feel are threatened by a recognition that climate change is real.
Yeah, and I think you do an excellent job of framing the reasons, like the four forms of distrust that you mentioned in the book, about why this debate has become so polarizing. You know, it is interesting, though, how often when you're talking to people who are climate change, you know, the anthropogenic climate change advocates, essentially, or believers, will say something like, you know, the scientific debate is over with, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not going to talk to these people anymore. It's just a waste of my time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are extreme positions on both sides of the debate, and unfortunately, they dominate the debate. And so scientists cringe when certain people overstate the science. That doesn't help either. And they also cringe when people totally reject the science. There are certain things that are pretty clear to scientists. There are certain things they're still trying to work out. But that doesn't negate the reality of what they're studying. And I do find it interesting in the public debate, there was a survey by Yale that found that 2/3 of Americans do not talk about climate change with friends and family. And so it seems that climate change is entering the realm of sex, religion, and politics of things you don't bring up in polite company.
Yeah, at one point, and maybe even towards the end of the book, where if you can't convince the uncle to have a civil discourse on the issue, then maybe it's better to talk football or something at the at the Thanksgiving table. Also, I mean, in addition to framing the reasons why this has become such a divisive issue and why people demonize each other on both sides of the issue, you do a lot with where do we go from here? And you call it a consensus-based path towards more constructive discussion. Take us along the topography of that path a little bit.
Well, we can in the book I lay out, you know, that to get to where I'm going, that when you find yourself engaged with someone who says that climate change is not real, if they have connected it to their personal identity, then giving them more data will only get them to dig the hills even harder. This is a very surprising and counterintuitive result. So if someone doesn't believe climate change is real, another IPCC report isn't going to change their mind. Because what they're talking about are, you know, fear of big government, distrust of the spokesman, as I said, distrust of the scenarios. I can go through the whole list of what they're reacting to, and it's not the science. And so presenting with more science, they just hear, well, you think I'm an idiot. So we can stop there and say, well, that's the form of the debate, but where can we go from here? And I lay out three approaches. And they really closely mirror the way we think about negotiations and dispute resolution. And so one is the optimistic path, which in negotiations we call the win-win, where we can create a solution where you don't have to change your beliefs at all. Everything will be fine, and the answer there is some killer technology that's going to make energy too cheap to meter, and you don't have to change anything. You can still live the life you've been living and have the beliefs you've had because technology saved the day. You can have the pessimistic path where things break down, where no one will change their beliefs and they expect the other to. And you can think the analogy for that is the abortion debate, where two sides are speaking two different issues, life and choice. Both sides only look for information that confirms their opinion and disconfirms the other, and they even demonize the other. And I call that a cultural schism. And that there are elements of that taking place now. But the third way is, what we teach in negotiations is you move off of positions and focus on interests. That's how you do effective negotiations. Someone makes a stand, you want to dig down. Why? What's the position for that stand? So on climate change, rather than, you know, hammering out, is climate change happening? No, it's not. Yes, it is. You're an idiot. No, you're an idiot. Let's go deeper and say, what are the elements, the underlying elements of the conversation, whether on a personal level, when you find that person across the Thanksgiving table who says that climate change is a hoax, can you dig deeper of what they're thinking or where they're coming from, understand how they're approaching the issue and what the full basis of their resistance is. I have a vignette in the book where I was talking to a friend, and he said, you know, he didn't know what I did. He said, what do you do? And I said, well, I teach. And what do you teach? Well, business and environmental issues. And he said, you mean like that climate change? That's not real, is it? And so I said, well, actually, the science is quite compelling. His next question is, are you a Democrat or Republican? And so I said, I'm an independent. And his next question is, what do you think of Al Gore? And I said, honestly, that I think that he called attention to the issue, but unfortunately, perceptions of him made it a partisan issue. It became too connected to Democratic politicians. What he was doing there was trying to figure out whether he trusts me, whether he wants to hear me. And the worst thing I could have done in that situation was start a science lecture or start to lecture him on the car he was leaning up against with the Hemi motor or any one of a number of tracks that would get people to just shut down and say, I'm sorry, I really didn't want to have this conversation and I really resent your tone of zealousness and self-righteousness.
My guest is Dr. Andy Hoffman. He is the Holcim Director, Holcim Professor and Director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. And so, you get to that point where, okay, what is your response then? And one thing that comes through your book, too, the importance of the language that we use when we engage in these kinds of discussions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the words you choose are very important. Let me back up. The book is all, it's a compilation of all the social science out there on this issue. So everything is grounded. The book is like 100 pages, but it has 20 pages of citations. So I'm really trying to bring everything together to give you a dense serving of all the social science that's out there. And there's some interesting social science on what happens when you use global warming and what happens when you use climate change in these conversations. And the majority of the research says that when you're talking to audiences that are liberal and believe that climate change is real, and I should point out that the majority of liberals and Democrats believe climate change is real. The majority of Republicans and conservatives do not. Now, I want to put a caveat on that and that, you know, explain that through motivated reasoning, but we all do it. So where it may be the conservative right that's against the science on climate change, it's actually the liberal left that's against the science on the safety of GMOs. We all do it. You have to reach people with a message that they'll appreciate. And so as an example, the scientists were going to the Vatican saying, you know, you got to attend to climate change. And they were coming back with a lukewarm response saying that's really about the environment. That really isn't our sweet spot. And then finally people said, well, wait a minute. No, it's not about the environment. It's about social equity because the world's poor are going to get hit first and hardest, and they didn't do it. And that got the church's attention. The Vatican's going carbon neutral right now. And that it illustrates the power of the frames that are out there that you can use. You can talk to people about managing risk. And if there's a low probability, high consequence event, then we take out insurance. You know, the odds of my house burning down are low. The impact on my finances would be devastating. So I take out insurance. And so on climate change, someone may say the probability is low that someone's going to hit, but what if you're wrong? Can we take that hit? The answer is no. What's the insurance? It's technology and behavior change, really trying to do something about this. You can frame it as national security. There's a group of Army generals that has done that, saying this is a threat multiplier that's going to make things more unstable around the world. You can frame it as economic competitiveness. If we don't develop the new technologies and energy and renewable energy, then Germany and China are going to do it, and we're going to buy it from them. One frame that social scientists have found is particularly effective is the health frame, and that if we have weather events related to climate change, in particular extreme heat in urban centers, it's the vulnerable that will get hurt, the senior citizens and the young children. And that resonates for people because, you know, the challenge here is making this personally salient. And you can do that with a health frame because we at least have senior citizens that we care about and probably have children or grandchildren or nieces or nephews that we care about as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned the generals. We've had two or three members of the CNA Military Advisory Board that frame this, as you mentioned, in the context of national security. There's a group in Michigan called, and you may be familiar with them, the Michigan Conservative Energy Forum. their frame more is more economic development and efficiencies of manufacturing, et cetera. And you mentioned people like Christine Todd Whitman and other conservatives who have ways of framing this issue along the lines that that have become pretty effective spokespersons. And as you say in the book, these are people that folks on one side of the issue might listen to because they trust them.
Right. Along with the frame that is used, the messenger is as important as the message. It's that simple. You know, I sit in a university. I'm an academic. There are some people who just won't listen to me because they don't trust academics. That's fine. Who will they listen to? And that's the key, is you have to find people who will speak to audiences that audience will trust. So there are conservatives out there talking about this. Unfortunately, they're, for the most part, former politicians. It's still sort of connected to the Republican Party, that position that climate change is not real. I'm hopeful and curious to see how this will play out. The Pope's upcoming encyclical letter on the environment, if he comes out and says, weighs into the climate change debate, and I don't know if he will or not. He is definitely on the environment. I don't know where he's going to go on climate change. But if he does, will that get political cover for some conservative Republican politicians to come out and say, you know what, it's not inconsistent for me to be a Republican and also acknowledge that climate change is real? There's some on the local level that have done it, mayors and so forth, but at the national level, it's still somewhat difficult.
Yeah, we just did an interview with, you may know him, George Hartwell up in Grand Rapids. Yeah, old friend and frequent guest on this program. But I will have to tell you, at one point in the interview, George made a sort of an interesting statement. And he said, you know, I'm so busy trying to be a decent mayor. He said that I really have got to figure out where to put my time and energy. And he said, arguing climate change with folks who are simply not going to change their mind is not where I'm going to put my time and energy. And here's George as a minister, as you know, who understands values and social science and the humanities and what have you. But what would you say to George after he makes a comment like that?
I would agree with him. And I think the operative sentence in that, or words in that line, is those who are not going to change their mind. And so I talked about that pessimistic path of forcing others to accept your beliefs. And I conclude the book with that. If you find yourself talking to somebody who is not open to a genuine conversation, then talk about football, because you're just gonna lock heads. And so, but if you can talk to people who are trying to figure this one out, who actually are in a period of honest inquiry, which I think is the vast majority of people in the middle, to add to that, then I think he's right. And I also will add that there are a lot of municipalities that are doing things to prepare for the weather consequences of climate change, whether it's storm surge or increased rainflow. They just are not calling it climate change because they don't want to weigh into the debate. I've talked to a number of people in the business community, the exact same thing. They say, you know, our growing patterns are changing. We're making adjustments, but I'm not going to use the words climate change because I don't need that political headache to go along with shifts in my business strategy.
We've done, since we last talked, and you did a book in term that was targeted at CEOs, but it's amazing how many business executives we've talked to in the last couple of years that are called vice presidents of sustainability or managers of sustainability, small companies, large companies, corporations like Ford. Do you sense among corporate America it just this growing sense that this is what we've got to do?
Well, certainly sustainability is a broad issue. It's
right.
Something that companies are having to attend to. Climate change is part of the portfolio. I think one interesting development is that climate change dominates the conversation right now. Water is actually about to really start to eclipse it.
Yeah.
And that's really the physical manifestation of climate change. And you can monetize water a whole lot easier than greenhouse gas emissions. Talk to anyone who's trying to do any kind of water-dependent business in California right now. They're really scrambling to figure out what they're going to do as water becomes more scarce and, appropriately, the cost of it goes up.
Yeah, I was just out there and had a chance to drive down some of those reservoir topographies, and it's unbelievable out there.
Studies now are saying that California has 1 year of water left. Then you can take a look at places like São Paulo, Brazil. They are about to run out of water. And you can talk to people there, and the water quality is pretty poor because they're getting down to the bottom of these reservoirs. And, you know, a city can run out of energy. Sewers can back up. you can get through. You run out of water, you have to leave.
One positive, though, and it occurs to me, when you look at all the bipartisan legislation to save the and help the Great Lakes, water seems to be one of those terms where you don't have the divisiveness across the political spectrum. People seem to be on the same page in many cases when it comes to water.
Well, here, because we have these Great Lakes that we share in common, but, you know, the joke in the West is that whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. I mean, water rights are very contested in places of the West.
Absolutely.
Take it away from people, and good luck.
Yeah. Well, we're about out of time. I want to mention the book again. It's How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate. It is just out by Professor Andrew Hoffman. It's a Stanford University Press brief. I'm two-thirds of the way through it, Andy. It's an outstanding book that I'm going to recommend to many, many people. And it's certainly been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. The pleasure was all mine. Thank you very much.
I've been talking with Andrew Hoffman. He is the Holcomb Professor and Director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. Andy, good to talk to you again.
Good talking to you, too.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association with another observation from The Spartan Life. What happens when desire or circumstance puts you outside of your comfort zone and into that terrifying position where you must re-envision your future? Press reset. Colleen and I got new phones this week. After many years as iPhone people, we are moving to the Samsung Galaxy 5. It's a different ecosystem, and we're rebuilding our application suite from scratch. It's been a sometimes frustrating, ultimately enlightening experience. Our phone desktops now look totally different. We've recreated some of the familiar, but have also discovered new and better ways to leverage our smartphones to best serve our needs. The environment is always in flux. Disruptors are everywhere. What happens if you're an iPhone and your customer decides to switch to an Android? Here's a fact of life. If your job isn't at risk now, it likely soon will be. What happens if you are forced to press the reset button? Well, first and foremost, keep calm. This is the natural progression of life. We are meant to periodically shed our cocoon and spread new wings. Keep breathing, keep centered, and look past the fear and into the realm of opportunity. Take stock of your skill portfolio. It's likely that you already have a strong career toolbox in place. What are your strengths? In your current position, what do you perceive as your liabilities? Take the broad view. How could your skill set be deployed in an emerging industry? Imagine someone approaching you with a job offer in a new, innovative company. How could you become an asset? Put your ego into the box. Your body of work, no matter how extensive, may or may not help you when you press the reset button. Hold your temper. If someone in a position of power doesn't appreciate all that you have to offer, gives you a cubicle instead of the office you used to have, takes away your company car, or makes you pay for your own cell phone. Look at it from the company's point of view, and you may be able to figure out how to get what you need by helping them get what they need. Sharpen your saw. Stephen R. Covey's seventh habit of highly successful people is something you should always be doing. Learn a new skill. Figure out how to be more productive, more effective, more useful. Keep learning how to become the best in the world at what you do. Create a new desktop. Now is the time to look over your behaviors and habits. Are there things that no longer serve their purpose? Revisit the timeless behaviors common to all successful people. Are you proactive? Are you anticipating the future state of your industry, your company? When was the last time you helped your boss innovate? What time are you getting up in the morning? What are you doing before you go to work to ensure you have a productive day? When was the last time you revisited your goals? Add value. Companies don't give out jobs, they hire solutions. Find a way to add value right now, right where you are, and do it. And finally, repeat. These activities, when repeated over and over, invariably generate wealth. Keep applying them. Your future vision will become clearer, and you will be able to capitalize on new horizons. Remember, no matter how secure you may feel in your current position, there is one truth you can always count on. Things will change. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
MSU Ag Bio Research is really centered around leading research and developing scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and environment.
Doug Buehler leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
Our history bases us in Michigan, but we've really expanded that mission to the nation and to the world.
MSU Ag Bio Research has more than 300 scientists representing seven MSU colleges.
We're very interested in continuing to build international linkages because of the importance of what we do and the global nature of agriculture and the global nature of a lot of the problems that we currently face.
MSU Ag Bio Research is leading research and scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and the environment in Michigan, the nation, and around the world.
The core is that we do research on food, energy, and agriculture. The reality is that those three things are important to everybody every day of their life.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
Sing our love for alma mater.
So what that means is when you graduate from college, we'll help you find your first career. When you move to any city, anywhere, we'll help you connect and settle. If you're mid-career and want to reinvent yourself, we'll help you find a new passion. And if you need advice or a friend anywhere in the world, the MSU Alumni Association will connect you with the 500,000 Spartans out there that are always ready to take your call.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu.
And thy praises
alumni.msu.edu. Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear the show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.